it in. I feel awful.
Sorry. Because you guys used to put
the jury in. So, my business school, for the MBA, I took the jury, law from the LSAT. And the year after I
Friends like, you know, they're part of the do away with standardized test thing, show up in the LSAT venue.
For the jury is that if you're not making the law school, don't you just like bring it to move the jury because that's a broader pool. Like, jury is more usually running tests, but not for
yourself. Yeah, that's where we are.
Come on to the provost, even though you didn't chime in because everyone else did. I figured you were okay. So instead of bugging you by email, I just went ahead and sent him. And he seemed, he wrote back right away saying, just cordial thanking me and saying he looks forward to working with us on it. So I think it's a good start. I wanted to let you know because I. Well, we'll see how things go today.
Motion to approve.
Next up, actually, considering we have a guest, I would ask the committee to essentially move out of order, moving directly into the presentation of the votes council. Just ready to set to Ryan, all yours. The budget introduces welcome Ryan Harper, the outvoted to the votes council.
If you have any questions or any things you'd like to speak about, please raise your hand or placard and I'll add to the speaker's list.
Hey everybody, for those of you who haven't met me, my name is Ryan Parker. Like Matt said, I'm the outgoing JCC, Judicial Codes Counselor, and I'm at 3L in the law school. For those of you who aren't familiar with our office, the Office of the Judicial Codes Counselor represents student, staff, and faculty that are charged with violations of one of Cornell's codes. Typically, that falls into the code conduct, policy 6.4, which is the university's policy concerning Title IX, and the code of academic integrity. We do have a few cases every year that fall outside of those parameters, but those are three big buckets that we deal with every year. We're supported by the office of the president, who does a fantastic job making sure that we have the administrative assistance, space, office, everything we need. Other than that, we're a very self-sufficient office. We need three other law students, one of the 3L and two L's. We were contacted this year by 233 individuals, which is a 24% increase over last year. Not all of those are we had just over 54 academic integrity cases this year, which is about a 10% decrease from last year. Keep in mind that a lot of our academic integrity cases come during finals, so we anticipate that number will be about even with last year. We had 103 so far in conduct cases, which is a 30% increase from last year, and we have 37 6.4 cases this year, which is a 37% increase. So our case numbers went up significantly this year, but most importantly, our long-term high workload cases increased significantly this year. So we're in the number of cases that was the workload associated with that case. In terms of office changes this year, that drove what our office focused on. With the permission of the president's office, this year we hired an additional assistant JCC for the upcoming year. So the office will be moving 5 JCCs starting next year, which we're kind of starting out on a trial basis. The previous JCC, my predecessor, was very focused on institutional knowledge. And that's something that we still care a lot about. We care about updating our records and files, both the case numbers, outcomes, and the sample documents for the JCC. But given the caseload, that's definitely something that moved into the maintaining cavity versus something that we need to do. In terms of updates, I'll organize it under 6.4 incident conduct and activate integrity and take the questions. As a caveat, this update is in my capacity as a JCC, so it's just primarily as an advocate for respondents. So these are all of the things that we as an office see as procedural issues or substantive issues that we have to advocate for respondents under various codes. With 6.4, I have to say that our interactions with that office and the process itself has dramatically improved this year. Case times are still extremely long, but to some extent, that's due to the nature of the investigation. And the office does a good job advancing and moving on those cases as quickly as they can. We still, as an office, support the use of outside contractors, investigators, to respond to fluctuations in complaints and cases that aren't necessarily something that the Title IX office can predict. Our main concerns with 6.4 are the same as they've always been. There's a lack of avenues for advocacy, which becomes an issue and is a special problem when we have respondents who English that are not their first language and they have difficulty with English. It limits our ability to advocate for them and to make sure that they're adequately expressing themselves. Additionally, as we've said for many years now, our office still supports a clear and convincing standard for 6.4 instead of the standard. The largest issue that we've noticed this year, though, is not something that I personally have a solution for, just something that we've noticed. We've seen a dramatic increase in what we refer to as weaponized Title IX complaints. We've had a lot of respondents over the last few springs come in, and they've either been threatened or there actually was a complaint where part of the reason the complaint was filed was to keep them from graduating. Given the timeline of the Title IX process, that leaves us, and especially the respondent, in a difficult position, and we really don't have the time or avenues to deal with that. So a newer trend that we notice in the 6.4 context. Moving to campus code of conduct, this is our highest number of cases numerically. Traditionally, it has not been our highest volume of hours because they often involve first-time violations, minor violations, are usually quicker cases. That's not necessarily true this year. The biggest changes that we notice with the code of academic integrity is the exercise by the Office of the Judicial Administrator this year of overlapping the concurrent jurisdiction with some other offices around the campus. For example, and probably most significantly, the Office of the Judicial Administrator has begun exercising joint jurisdiction with the Office of Fraternity and Sorority Life in order to investigate fraternity and sorority hazing allegations. That's, of course, with a significant increase in our trainings for hazing respondents and with the number of instruction cases we have from fraternities or members. Typically, that happens because a witness either fails to respond to the or fails to contact in the process. That's led to a number of changes in our internal policies. The policy of Kendall Carr, my predecessor, was not to represent witnesses, both because from a manpower perspective, we don't have that capacity, and because it creates conflicts in our office. We try to make sure that we're not representing both the respondent and the witness to the same incident, and representing the potential to be witnesses in an office. However, because we had such a high number of witnesses being called in for these joint investigations, we modified our policy this year. We still do not represent individual witnesses in the sense of if you saw someone drinking, but we have begun not representing, but providing advice to group witnesses. So, for example, if a pledge class or an entire class year of a fraternity or sorority is called in, we go in and serve as kind of like an independent resource. We make it very clear that we're not serving as their advisor, we're not a financial resource, but we're there to answer their questions. And we're very thankful to the Office of Judicial Administration for coordinating that with us. They reach out to us and let us know when there's going to be something in the fraternity or sorority investigation. So we make sure our representative is there. Additionally, we also applaud the Office of JA's use of educational sanctions. That's something that is not reflected in a lot of other portions of the code, but is very much a part of the JA's sanctioning philosophy. In particular, we know the decision reflection matrix that they instituted this year. In the past, and still to some extent now, there are rather cookie cutter summary decision agreements that are proposed for respondents. But the decision matrix provides an avenue for respondents to engage in reflection about their alleged wrongdoing, but allows them to customize it to something that they're more interested in. We appreciated that this year. Our main disagreement, I would say, over the educational sanctions used by the Office of the Judicial Administrator are the lack of oral warnings. We find that the disciplinary records imposed on students are not an educational sanction, and the lack of oral warning we think has had negative impacts on respondents across campus. In 2016, the Office of the Judicial Administrator gave out 225 oral warnings. In 2017, the year that the Office of the Judicial Administrator changed their policy away from allowing oral warnings, they gave out 24. And then in 2018, the office gave out 12. We don't have the numbers for 2019, obviously, but we anticipate there will be a similarly low number. That results in disciplinary records for first time low level offenses that remain with the respondents until graduation, or in the case of disciplinary probation, if they're a freshman, for 10 years. And that's something that we feel isn't necessarily an educational outcome for the respondent. Additionally, it's reduced the number of sanctions available and has led to disciplinary records being something that's at the forefront of most respondents' mind. Now, instead of having oral warnings, written reprimands, and disciplinary probation, hearing panels only have written reprimands, disciplinary probation as options unless they're looking at a need from the university, such as a suspension or a dismissal. So it's reduced the options that the OJA has, and that in turn goes in summary decision agreements. We would also recommend significant changes to the joint hearing process. There have been a number of joint hearings this year that resulted in greater adjudication times for respondents. We found that they're highly prejudicial because respondents are viewed as a singular unit versus as an individual circumstances, and it's reduced the ability of respondents to exercise their right to a hearing on sanctions only. They accept responsibility, but another member of that joint hearing requests responsibility, and all members currently have to go through a hearing on merits before they can receive the sanctions. In short, it's a procedural headache, and we have significant reservations in the process. I will just briefly state that this is the shortened version of what will be a written report that I'll be sending out at the end of the month. So I apologize for the brevity, but there should be more details later this month. Lastly, and most problematically, is the academic integrity code. Last year, when my predecessor Kendall met with the UA, she called the code of academic integrity a procedural nightmare. And that is definitely still true today. There have not been any substantive or procedural changes to that code. It's, for those of you who don't know, a completely decentralized system. Each college has its own hearing pool, hearing panel, and as I'll mention in the second hearing process, and that results in an inconsistent and contradictory procedural and substantive decisions. Beginning substantively, there's a complete lack of educational sanctions along the route. It's usually grade penalties or failing the class, which is a grade penalty, or notation on a transcript. We would recommend education sanctions, having to rewrite assignments, coupled with appropriate grade penalties as a way to actually educate respondents. There's no clarity on the reporting system, whereas the JAA's office is very clear about what disciplinary records are created, how long they will be maintained, and where they will be reported. We do not have that in the academic context, which makes it very difficult for us to advise clients about where this is going to be reported, what their reporting obligations are, when they apply to grad school jobs, which handicaps our ability to be effective advisors. And then lastly, for substantive differences, professors or clients with different professors or in different colleges have completely different outcomes despite having the exact same gap pattern. So for example, freshmen who are in freshman writing seminar with two different professors can have substantive and serious citation errors, failure to quote passages in their paper in one class, so they're given a letter grade reduction on that paper and be made to rewrite it. In another class, they'll be failed in that class. And there's really no, there's no use of case law, so there's no ability for us to say, this is not normal, this is not what is being done in other classes. That's not persuasive. Which brings us to procedurally, the issues that we have with academic integrity is there's no uniformity across colleges. Some colleges allow us to serve as advisors and advocates and speak in hearings. Others will not allow us to speak at all in hearings. Some colleges have unilaterally changed the burden of proof in their academic integrity hearings, despite not having the authority to do so, and have changed the burden of proof from proof of convincing evidence to preponderance. There's no jurisdictional element in code of academic integrity. So we've seen interesting cases where professors have been grade penalties for classes that the student has already completed for one of their friends cheating in a subsequent class. A lot of the colleges that have diverse or non-consistent procedures maintain that these are on file, that but we're not given access to them. So in other words, they say there's a secret set of rules that we're playing by, but you can't have access to them. And there's no conflicts requirement in the code of academic integrity. So this leads to situations where a hearing chair is serving as an independent witness in the same case that comes before them. It leads to situations where hearing panels are hearing two different cases that they've already heard. So for example, if two respondents allegedly cheat together and they sentence the first respondent, that same hearing panel, despite being intimately familiar with the facts and the arguments and already having reached a decision, will hear the case of the other respondent. And it also leads to situations where, for example, the judicial administrator has been called in as witness in cases that she's also pursuing under the campus code of conduct. And there's no ability to challenge that. And depending on what college it's in, there's no ability for us to even speak in that way to respond to that occurrence. Overall, I think our office has had a really great year. We've had a dramatic increase in cases, and I know a lot of this sounded problematic, because a lot of it is. But the good news is most of this is stuff that can be addressed with code revisions and with clarity. So I know that we've been promised code revisions for a few years now. And I know my predecessor said the same thing. Further talk. But the thing that I would encourage you to all think about, if when and if you see code revisions next year or the following year, is to look to what has worked in the other codes. So for example, code of academic integrity does not have a lot of the requirements, due process rights that campus code of conduct or even 6.4 have. And we've seen the impact. The outcomes are worse. The due process violations are worse. So I will encourage you to think twice before removing the due process protections from the union.
Thank you, please join me. Thank you, Ryan. Any questions?
Yeah, so kind of something you haven't touched on. This is the second year in which the JCC's office has played a role in one of the major elections on campus for students, which I think in continuously, I don't really think it's fair for your office to be involved in the election process whatsoever as an arbitrator. I think there's a better model that we can pursue, but I would like to hear from your perspective of, do you believe the JCC's office should continue playing a role in these elections? Would you want to be cut out of the whole entire thing and not have to deal with it? Because I think overall, for the past 2 years, I've seen mostly undergraduate students not particularly like what ends up happening with anything.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think as I said, I'm in charge of representing faculty, student, staff who are charged with violations of one of those codes. We're advocates. And when we are involved in the election process, we're called to be an independent reviewer in some capacity. And that's very much not in the spirit of the JCC office. It's not what we do. It's on the annual actual exercise for us to write a bias report or a procedural review of an election decision. But I think there are other resources and other people better suited to do that. So, no.
Can you make a recommendation on that?
Yeah, it'll be in the report. I do not have the office that I think is best suited. I have a few that people have told me are potential. Potentially a good substitute, but I'll include this.
Thank you. Next is Charlie.
Yeah, so say Professor A on day one says, you plagiarize on this term paper, you get an F. Professor B on day one, different course, says, you plagiarize, you rewrite it, and I'll take you down half a grade. Does your office see that as inconsistent?
So the Code of Academic Integrity is really clear that faculty have the right to wear, or have the duty, right, depending on how you phrase it, to, if there's any difference in there, it's from the Code of Academic Integrity to state that up
front. Right.
I don't see that as inconsistent when the professor has done that in the syllabus. I think where we have an issue is where it's not stated in the syllabus, or, for example, a lot of times the hearing panel and the professor don't say what violation of Code of Academic Integrity is. So, for example, for lab reports, we have a lot of issues where copying certain parts of the lab report are okay, such as the procedures, but the professor is very clear in the syllabus that you can't copy graphs, data, and something else. As long as it's stated in the syllabus, I don't see that as problematic. I think my issue is that for all the most severe cheating, failing to enforce, and I think this is a personal position more than an office position, is an extreme
situation. Right, sure. Okay, so you listed a bunch of situations, and I agree there's lots wrong with the code, but in your report, will you be able to name names? For example, College X did this, College Y did that. Will you be able to give that kind of detail, and would you then circulate your report to all the colleges for comment?
So my reservation with doing so is that we can go in front of the exact same hearing chair and the exact same hearing panel. And we've already seen instances where we appeal things or cause a fuss about just procedural inaccuracies, and then we go in front of the same hearing panel, and it affects our advocacy for an upcoming client. So I think I would provide examples. I wouldn't always provide the college unless it was something that happened across multiple colleges. So to some extent, I will provide specifics for others if it's something where they will know exactly what you know exactly.
Oh yeah, obviously confidentiality. Yeah. Thank you.
Next, I have Linda.
Hi. It's really hard to sit here and hear this litany of issues with this year after year. And so these seem like serious enough that they could really throw someone's career like off track. And it seems like we really need to do something. So I would like to understand how this is being addressed. If it is being addressed in our proposed code revision, when are we going to actually do something about this? I mean, I'm not going to be here anymore, but I hate to listen to this and think about the people being affected.
To clarify, the code of academic integrity, you probably know better than I do, the code of academic integrity is actually separate from the campus code of conduct.
Right. So are we doing anything about these issues?
So the code of academic integrity, I can speak last year when I was serving as chair of the code initiative committee, we looked at it, we talked about it, but we were largely focused on the versions of campus code of conduct, CJC this year likewise. I know it was talked about at least briefly. It's just that the bandwidth, we were focused on the code versions. It is right now the code of integrity is a faculty matter. So I know we had spoken with some people, such as Reese Liberts, being a faculty member at Faculty Center. We'd spoken with her, we'd spoken to some other individuals about issues with it. It remains on the radar, but that's the current state of academic integrity as far as the UA is concerned. I would encourage next year's assembly to continue to look at it and actually prepare to make it a higher priority if time permits, because as Ryan said, it is an ongoing issue. It's been flagged. Not even just Ryan's presence, but I've known JCCs for going back 4 or 5 years. It's been flagged even going back to Amanda Minicus, which was the JCC in the 2014-15 year, that this is an issue, and it's been kind of fast, unfortunately.
So this is actually in your purview?
Yeah, so every, as you said, it is decentralized. Every college has a board, and every board has a chair, and we get together about once a year to talk about stuff. This has come up. The tough nut to crack there is colleges have different views of things. You know, some are very technical colleges, others, you know, so it's hard to get some kind of uniform standard there. But I think most of our attention has not so much been on the code. Again, I don't want to exaggerate, you know, one meeting a year. Maybe we need more, maybe we have to orchestrate something more systematic. But I think the focus is on what is perceived to be an increase in cheating, basically, and what to do about it. And
thank you.
Next, I have Joe.
So I'm interested in, for policy 6.4, you said there's an increase in weaponized Title IX complaints. Who do you see, like what demographic area do you see as the complainants who are weaponizing their complaints? Are they students doing that? That's the question.
I don't think there's a single characteristic that unites complainants or potential complainants who have indicated that that's part of their analysis. I also want to be really clear. We have cases that are filed right before someone graduates or in the months leading up to their graduation that don't fit this weaponized Title IX complaint. So I'm speaking specifically about situations where someone affirmatively indicates that was part of their consideration, that they wanted to keep something. And I don't think there's a really good time to care for that.
Okay. Thank you. Next, I have Dan, then Chris, then Richard.
Yes, so my first question is about the Code of Academic Integrity hearings. When you say the procedures aren't ever shared with the JCC for the most part, are they shared with the students in advance of the hearing?
So all of the colleges do a really good job. They all have templates, and I haven't seen any instances this year where the professor in contact with the student does not use the template, which gives them our information to the Code of Academic Integrity that's maintained on the faculty website. Our issues usually come when the hearing chair or the professor deviates from that code of academic integrity.
And how are they allowed to do that?
I mean, they're not, but we have instances of hearing chairs affirmatively saying ignore procedural arguments, they're not relevant. And in some colleges, we can't speak, so it's a written out statement that we prepare for the respondent that says, it was inappropriate for X, Y, and Z to happen. This is a procedural error, extremely prejudicial. For that reason, I should be found not responsible, which is not a sympathetic argument for a hearing panel call to assess whether or not that interview should So it's not the situation that would necessarily change the outcome of all of the cases. There's the potential for some cases. It's just that the procedure isn't being followed. So we just have crazy outcomes.
And is there any recourse for students? I don't actually know the specifics of the Code of Academic Integrity for when procedure is not followed in the hearings.
Yes, we've had a lot of success appealing to deans. I would say on average, when the deans see something particularly egregious, it's a cause for concern for them. At that point, though, they're usually not challenging the finding of responsibility. And so we're negotiating with the dean through an appeal for reduced sanctions. And that doesn't necessarily translate to the next time you go back to that college, a different procedure.
And just if we could talk quickly, I don't know, this might be more of a question for Charlie. Is there anything that can be done to enforce uniform involvement of JCCs in hearings? Because that, separate from the actual procedures of the hearing and the rules and standards of evidence, is there anything that can be done to make sure that at least for every student that's going into a hearing that they can use the JCC and use them in the same ways?
Well, I know if something goes wrong in, like, in the primary hearing level, it shows up in the hearing board level where you guys show up, right? So what's the scene? I mean, are you spotting departures from procedures at the hearing board levels? And
yeah, so the professor level, we don't worry as much about, but it definitely happens. Like, for example, the Code of Academic Integrity says that professors have to present them with what the violation was and the evidence before they have to respond. So, for example, occasionally you'll have a respondent walk in and the professor says, why'd you do it? And what did you do? And the respondent has to try and navigate that. That's less common and less troubling for us, to be perfectly honest. It's the departures at that secondary hearing level with a hearing panel that are more problematic. We don't attend primary hearings because we don't want that to be an adversarial process. But then sometimes when we attend that hearing panel, that's where we're not allowed to speak or see the previous change.
Next is Chris.
Thank you for this report. I wish I got this at the beginning of the year when I joined last year. So focusing still on the academic integrity code, because this is brand new information as an employee and how these kind of things work. You mentioned that because of the decentralization, you get to a certain point in any college where you get to the secret rules. And is there, in the report, sort of like Charlie mentioned a little bit about naming names, is there at least a level of where that consistently is across the university? And I have a follow-up on that.
Yeah, so, and I want to be clear, some of the colleges actually do a fantastic job following the procedure, letting us the advocates. And I think more than calling out certain colleges, what I would probably do is say that these are colleges that either through their training procedure or enforcement by the hearing chairs have had consistent application of the code. And kind of allow them. Yeah, but to get to your question, the Code of Academic Integrity, it's been a while since I've read this provision, any deviations by the individual colleges are supposed to be approved by the Faculty Senate. Only two are noted in the Code of Academic Integrity, the law school and the best. Everybody else is supposed to be using Code of Academic Integrity as written and recorded on the faculty website. Any that are approved but not noted in the Code of Academic Integrity are supposed to be maintained on file. And I believe it's the Dean of Students office, but there's a specific office named in the code that would have to have those on file. And so that would be kind of the source of, all right, pull whatever PowerPoints, procedures are maintained there that are not consistent, and say, are these approved, are these not? We can have these procedures,
and getting that list of who is doing this well is going to be very important, I think, because at least the way it works in the employee side of things is you start to model after other places. And what I can imagine is, one, you have to respect the individual cultures of the colleges themselves, because like Charlie mentioned, technical versus how they do different things. But it is expensive to have a whole set of different administration of all these different rules. And what really makes people change minds is how much money is being spent on things like that. So instead of it necessarily saying, hey, your faculty is spending a lot of time fighting about academic integrity stuff where they could be teaching or inventing or getting a grant, here is this sort of seminal or set of procedures that we want everybody to adopt, and that gives you some flexibility depending on what your college is, but overall, it takes something that would take you normally this many people and this many hours and shrinks it down to this so that everybody can keep on moving on. So that gives me a good point about how to try to approach this issue. So thank you.
Next is Richard.
So Ryan, that was a wonderful report. Thank you very much. When you write it up, a request that in addition to, you know, things that are wrong, sort of your best guess about fixes. Don't spend a lot of time on that because we're imposing on you. But I'd really like to see that. So the specific, we see what we're doing. The second thing is really about the size of your office. So my understanding is that it's been increased now. Is it the right size? But hold on that for a moment. And the third thing has to do with everybody's asking about it, academic integrity. The impression among my colleagues is not only that there's variation in the process, but that it doesn't work very well. And so that many of the cases of plagiarism are settled or, you know, something happens outside of this process because they don't trust it. I'm talking about faculty now. So could you say something about the, let's call it the conviction rate, as opposed to not upholding? I mean, the impression is that it's really a dice roll on my colleague's part. You know, either you enter the process and the chances are, you know, not good. You'll be upheld and you'll get some nasty business on the side. So tell me, say something about that. First, the size of your office.
So I think the size of our office, this is the second increase. I was going to really fully report, and then we had an increase from 2 to 4 in the early 2010s, sometimes between 2010 and 2013. I think we're right on the cusp of what we can handle with 4. It's definitely taken away from everybody in the office. His ability to do other things in the hospital. And I think we're at a point where we haven't hit the wall in terms of effective advocacy for our clients, but we've hit the wall in terms of recruiting potential. People who have ambition in the hospital, you can't do this, and so they're done in the hospital. A lot of other things in the hospital. So increasing the number allows us to attract the type of student we want. I think that more than anything is what has driven it, and also a desire to keep our hours a little closer to what we advertise them as. In terms of academic integrity, our reaction is very much the opposite. We encourage settlement and kind of getting outside of the process for the same reasons. We don't trust the process, and we found that if the professor and the student can agree on something that is mutually beneficial and bury it, that serves our clients well. I don't think that's the right thing. I think from an institutional perspective, that's not what we want to happen. But we very much find that, except in extreme cases, we do not win at the hearing panel stage. The hearing panel with 40% faculty, 50% student with a faculty hearing chair from that college, and whether true or not, the perception among respondents is that given 50% faculty, the faculty will support the faculty member, and all you have to do at that point is go to a stalemate and get the hearing chair, or convince one of the students who is also in that college to side with the faculty. So we very much encourage students to not go to a hearing. If they can find any way to settle the debate or encourage the faculty to perceived as reasonable to them to settle it that way, which is why we would go to the primary hearing at first meeting.
I have Joe, then Andy, then Linda.
So you mentioned the JA's office overlapping jurisdictions, specifically Office of Sorority and Fraternity Life. I'm interested explaining more upon that. Is that the JA's office going through the investigation process of a group hazing complaint? Is it helping OSFL members you know, make decisions of those Hasten complaints and how that happens, because of the unique nature of the whole entire two. So where does the JA's office role kind of play essential in that?
So we only have one example where we've gotten the equivalent of discovery. We've seen kind of where the JA's office came into the process and what their role was. Some of those questions, I don't know what standard practice is. Mm-hmm. And this is a relatively new process by the JA. This is something that only happened this year. I think what we found is when a report comes in, it names a fraternity hazing incident, the JA immediately begins to participate. And it's kind of through that investigation process, both the Office of Fraternity and Sorority Life and the JA, rather than going through two investigations or one completes an investigation and forwards the conclusions to the other, are participating in the investigation together. So sharing transcripts, sharing investigators, sharing interviews with witnesses. In terms of what is being recommended in terms of outcomes, I have no meeting in charge there or what that conversation looks like.
Thank you. Next, I have Andy.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about syllabi. And yeah, I know that you mentioned that in order for you guys to find it useful, that it's better if you list the violation specifically. I was wondering if there's maybe a reference to like the website of Academic Integrity that would be sufficient for you guys to use, or if it needs to be listed directly on the website.
So I think my point about syllabus was more that Code of Academic Integrity gives faculty flexibility. Mm-hmm. So their course is unique, and their learning objectives are unique, meaning students do not engage in certain behaviors which you got, they can note that on their syllabus. And when they do so, that's not a problem for us, especially if they communicate to all the students in the class. If there's a violation, there's a violation at that point, and it's clearly different on the syllabus. Where we have problems is where the educational outcomes are unique, and they want students to behave in certain ways, and students do not. And they may have even communicated that to students in class, but it's not reflected in the syllabus or code of academic integrity. So we can go to the hearing panel and say, I get that the professor does not want that behavior to occur, but that in and of itself is not a violation of the code of academic integrity. And part of this may be training the hearing panels where they're not taught about required elements for a violation of the hearing, or trained about their needs and methods as a standard. But yeah, that's specifically the issue we have. Any deviations from the code of academic integrity on the syllabus and communicated to the students.
Thank you.
And last but not least is Linda.
So I guess I've heard enough to make me think that if you're recommending to students that they circumvent the whole process because it's not really working, that it's time to take a systematic look at this whole thing and maybe incorporate the uncontested option as like the first tier, sort of like an uncontested divorce. You know, you work it out amongst yourselves. That's step one. If you can't do that, then you default. And then just some really clear procedural, you know, it just seems like it's time to take a systematic look at it. So I'm advocating for Charlie to put this on the agenda for the Faculty Senate for next year to actually look at.
Well, let me paint an even worse picture, which is that the faculty, like chairs, are advising assistant professors to look the other way because it's a morass and you can't afford the time. But there is, you know, so there, people, you know, as I said, we had this meeting and just take the thing. I think someone mentioned like a freshman amnesty kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but these things sound great, but then you start carving them into words, then you have like a free pass. You can do whatever, you know, there are a lot of hidden side effects, unintended side effects. So, but yeah, no, I'll look into it next year.
And it just seems like with your letter.
But really, yeah, I will.
So if you, with an eye to that, when you write your letter, what are the three main issues that, you know, should be looked at? Should there be an option? I'm not saying that there should be a free pass, but, you know, but like an option where the two parties, you know, try to resolve this on their own before going into the whole process. Something like, you know, what are the three things that really need attention, and then we can pass it.
Yeah. to add force to like doing something next year, it'd be handy if there are on if the reports for the last 5 years were online. If not, if you could just send me the AI section for each of, as far back as you can go, so we can say this has been a festering problem.
So we only have this will be the third written report for my office.
Okay.
Can definitely make sure that those sections are.
Yeah, separate. I have last year's, but if you get the one from the year before, it'd be great. Yeah.
And then the thing that I wanted to emphasize, I think as great as it would be for my office to just not have to deal with academic integrity cases because of the blanket amnesty for freshmen, that's definitely not what we are at. I agree with everything that both of you have said. I would also say another thing that should be incorporated is training. We have found, and this was included in the Lucas report, and it's been noted every time we've tracked it, that international students disproportionately are the ones engaged in academic integrity violations. And also, so way above their representation in the campus community. And a lot of times in our conversations with them, it is legitimately something they did not know. And regardless of whether it was clearly noted or put back in integrity, a lack of exposure to the system or students who came from high school that did not have a sophisticated English citation system or whatever program they're in now are the ones we found disproportionately impacted. I think ignoring the problem isn't the answer, but an education combined with
Thank you. An excellent report. And I agree the Faculty Senate should take this up and look. But just to give you another perspective, I'm sure there's differences in culture department by department. And in my department, I really don't think that any of the violations of the Code of Integrity go out at all outside of our department. We handle it internally. So, you know, I teach a 265 student freshman class and we handle it internally. So I suspect there's a lot of variation and larger scale of problems that might be apparent.
Okay, that exhausts the speakers list. Wait. Actually, Jeff, do you want
to? Just one quick thing, adding to that discussion, because obviously there's different avenues you can help, because when we talk about this academic integrity in terms of, it's mostly where there's a lack of transparency as to how things should be rolled out from the instructor's perspective in terms of what are the guidelines for assessment, right? What are the expectations from the students? Do you think one option is training from the individual instructor's level? Do you think there should be guidelines in terms of how, what things should you provide on a syllabus regarding this context so that, you know, cross campus, regardless of what college you're in, that there is at least a framework in place for, hey, this is how we would like as an institution to work. There's gonna be some flexibility for you and your college to have within that, but keep that, you know, mindset there.
So I think the default is, and I'm sure there's boilerplate, either department by department or across the university for faculty. And we very much would never contest that faculty do not include an academic portion, therefore there is no code of academic integrity. So we would very much, the code of academic integrity is the default. And kind of regardless of what syllabus, that's what we're going to work from. It's only when they deviate from the code back.
Norm, yeah.
So it's really just any departments that have significant needs or changes that need to be put into their syllabus, then maybe they should be flagging that to instructors. If you care about X, Y, and Z, that's not going to be covered in the code back.
Right.
And you should be noting it on your syllabus and communicating it.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of what I was leading to. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Thank you, awesome speakers. I will end it with you briefly with a quick question, then we ask this whole August. Is there anything additional this assembly can do to help you in your office? I hope you and I have regularly, I hope that will continue as well as your position in the Code of Leadership Committee, but is there any specific directors of advocacy, in terms of your advisor, or anything else that you think this assembly can do to help you, or just to say, you're a successor because you're graduates as well as I am, as you move forward into next year and beyond?
I don't think I have anything specific. We've been in the university. We appreciate all all the help from this committee and the president's office.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. Please join me. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you. Moving back into our agenda, we'll want to go back up to assembly committee update. The final update for our assembly debate. First, sorry about constituent assemblies.
We had our last meeting this past Thursday where we discussed several bylaw amendments, a quick change to Appendix A with some fun thrown in there. Let's see, other big things are the big things. Nope, not really. I'm going to move
that we continue with the resolutions because of how much time has already been spent, and we can come back to reports if we have time at the end of the meeting.
Yeah, I have like things to discuss with the tobacco survey.
So if the Senate is doing so, that being said, do they all be choose maintainers or remove the vote?
I withdraw the motion.
But if you'd like, we could skip assemblies and go right to the committee to that would be great both of you.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll go right to committees. And actually that means we'll go to CWC first. Keith, you're on.
Okay, so Joe, I don't know, did you
Yeah, I sent it out to the members. It was the second email today that I sent out to everyone.
Okay, so there's two potential posters and one finalized survey that have been sent out. The two posters, I guess the decision is which one do we want to use for publicity? Or, I mean, let me preface this by saying we are trying to release the survey in a staggered form. So the first aspect have already come out. That's the website. It's only gotten one response, so I think that kind of legitimizes the fact that we're doing this community engagement approach as well. The second aspect of the survey will be paper surveys to employees over the summer, and we want the posters for that to essentially share the word. Yesterday, I spoke with SRI about the potential budget of a survey, and they said it was upwards of $3,000. So I don't know whether we want to use SRI. That's something I wanted to talk about. It's actually, $4,500 to send out. I think it's like a 9-question survey by both email and paper mail to some employees, like union and trades workers, to send those by paper mail and then to send the rest by emails. 9 questions is $4,500. So comments on that also.
So I looked at those two posters. You know, they are prejudicial. They're,
okay.
They're anti-cigarette, which I mean, fine, sort of. But I would take the cigarette off of both of them because I think that's the main part that's prejudicial. It depends on whether you want. You know, to tilt towards a particular outcome, or you really want information from respondents. And in both cases, having the cigarette on that thing looked prejudicial to me. So that would be a suggestion.
The point of information for the chair, would that survey be within the budget of the University Assembly's budget? Would that be possible?
Yeah.
So I guess the question for the chair and for T, if we want to do the $4,000 survey, where would the funding have to come from?
We have to request it from somewhere in the administration or potentially not even the RI, even alternative. But again, if we have opposition, send a survey out so we can utilize that instead of email and then run through Qualtrics or some other method. Those would be alternatives, assuming we don't have the budget to use the RI.
David, did you have something to say?
I was just going to ask if we could request $4,500 from Martha's office. Whether or not that's appropriate, I have no idea.
I mean, the president called us here earlier in March. We sent him a support report when he really asked, and I'm not sure. We can also see what sort of funds the UA has and say, because we need a
part of the university and help make a difference, we would do that. Other comments or questions for Steve?
Yeah, so I just wanted to agree with this, Richard, and say that that was my initial read as well, just to take away like any bias that it could potentially be perceived that we have. And then my other question is, if have you looked into how much it would cost just to send it as an email and not do the paper form as well? And if you don't want to do that, that's fine too.
So with SRI, not doing the paper mails would be, and just doing the emails with SRI would be $1,500. So the three, like the bulk of it is that mailing aspect. That's still $1,500 though. I believe if we do Qualtrics, that's free. But we also have to do the analysis ourselves. We do have one member of the committee, David, who, I mean, has done similar work and so could help with the analysis. But that's something that, I mean, we would have to, you know, discuss. I told them that I would actually get back to them tomorrow. I mean, today, I mean, because I spoke to them yesterday, I get to, back to them today after your feedback. So, I mean, I kind of want to nip this in the bud. If we don't want to use SRI, I want to tell them straight up, like, no, we're not paying $500 and, you know, just cancel the thing. So, and I mean, the points about the cigarette are also well taken. For you both, I guess, would we just take out the cigarettes and keep the posters as they are? Or what suggestions would you have to modifying kind of the rest of the poster when we take those? Is there a way to like project the posters?
So I kind of like the idea of something very neutral. So I like the, I don't know if it's like red or pinkish salmon. I like that one better. I just feel like the other one's like a little bit playful with or without the cigarette. But the other one's kind of more like right at you. Like, do you want to participate? I would suggest seeing what it looks like just without the cigarette and maybe like adding something like super neutral of the same like yellowish color on the bottom. And not having
a picture?
Potentially, I would say to keep it, just my opinion, as like kind of plain as possible so that the words are the main thing that are reaching out to people. But then I'd also say that if we are able to do Qualtrics, I would suggest that we try that just because it's not a really hard system. And if it isn't a problem for us to, or some of us to be looking at the data, I've also done that as an undergrad here. And it could save us some money and hassle.
We have program actually. We program a demo with Qualtrics a while ago.
I'm going to make the REE small letters. And I love free too, but you know, it is a loaded word. And you're otherwise, I agree with you.
My opinion on this as an employee representative is that we make the ask of the president's office to fund this and then decide from there and see like David and I can figure out what we got to do to make sure it goes out. The reason for the paper survey, I can imagine, is all of the people that are most affected by this are like the dining hall and the grounds and those people who literally don't go in front of a computer at all for their job. And that was the whole point of this, is to try to get the maximum cast of the net. And SUNY Albany just said try to do this, and they got agreements from everybody at university level, including the unions. And then the day they went to implement it, the unions decided that they were going to sue to stop it from happening, and they wanted additional things like education and smoking cessation aids for those employees that were affected by it. So, you know, still trying to find that right balance here of how do we get everybody's opinion and how do we do it in a timely fashion so that we get maximum effect. I think it's a reasonable thing to say this is a question we want to ask the whole university. And I can imagine the big expenses administering the paper survey, collecting it, inputting it all in, and then running the data analytics about, you know, what age range of people all did whatever they did. So I don't know if we can decide it exactly right now. Of course, I'm interested, just like everybody, like, do it. But there is a couple different reasons why that sticking to some paper gets we get a better picture of the university.
So, do we vote to go ahead and do this? I mean, how do we have this on the record that we are in support of asking the president to fund SRI, and if that doesn't work, then we're going to do a Qualtrics. I mean, do we have this on the record somewhere that we've formally taken action?
Most of the work that we're going to be discussing is in Resolution 4 and the discussion on letters, which are both on the agenda, so we'll get to those.
We had our last meeting of the year a week ago today, and we finalized a memorandum to the provost on some specific suggestions for taking steps to reduce carbon footprint of the campus, particularly regarding business travel and commuting, but some other ideas as well. So a series of specific suggestions and then some general points of discussion. I sent it to the provost a day or so ago and got a polite and relatively affirmative response back saying, thank you, he's interested and he'll be talking to us.
Hearing none, that are there any updates from any of our various liaison positions, that be the policy advisory group, council, sexual violence prevention, campus planning committee, and or student health and advisory committee? Seeing no updates for those, actually the remainder of our GPSA faculty and employee assembly, are there any major updates for those assemblies that we've
The employee assembly held their elections today and re-elected David and myself to be the EA members who are appointed to the UA. We also had a thing where employees that are not part of the employee assembly are also appointed or elected, and Pilar Thompson, who previously has been in the EA and has some experience, is now just a normal person, but is going to join the UA. And then Bonnie Allen as well, who has been here, was also reelected. So I just want to say thank you. And our new chair of the employee assembly is Adam Howell, who is a second or third year employee that is at the CALS, somewhere funny in CALS, but he is also the fifth member that will be an employee representative to the university assembly.
I guess I want to also, writing on that update, we also have our elections yesterday, and Andy Valladares Gomez is the new GPS president. And we also elected three delegates to the UA, and Jeff is staying, and so is Logan, and James is not here today. So, yes, you'll be seeing him in fall.
Thank you. I'll move to the end of the day. First up is Resolution 4, appointment of the University Hearing and University Review Board members for academic year 2020.
So the resolution is the same as it was 2 weeks ago, except the last two names on lines 37 and 38 have been added to the one-year appointments for students, and the one name on line 55 for the one-year appointment for a staff member has been added. Every other name is the same as it was 2 weeks ago. These were chosen from applications that were anonymized and reviewed by the Codes and Judicial Committee. After the selections were made, they were then de-anonymized, put to this resolution, and the nominations are now being sent for the appointment by the University Assembly.
For those who may not be aware, you may do it here in the U-Boards, or you may hear me. In essence, if you are accused of violating the cast for conduct, they are the panel that you will hear in the panel report. So there will be an ongoing chair, and then members, three of the students, the UR, so if there's students, three students, or five of the staff, staff member, staff, faculty, et cetera, then you appoint them.
Motion to approve.
Second. Is there any sense of voting on the resolution? Hearing none, I will ask all those who are in favor of the resolution to please raise your hand.
Ellis.
I don't have a placard, does it?
Chair Shelton, I vote 15-0-1 resolution 4 passes.
Okay, this is another long-standing systemic issue that we've been trying to address, and Charlie very kindly volunteered to chair this committee. This is an opportunity for the constituent assemblies to gain some insight into the university budget process, and we're hoping that each of the assemblies will have representatives on this committee. Charlie will chair it, and one of the outcomes will be a document to try and make it more understandable how the budget process works, so that everybody here understands all of the complexity that goes into these discussions. And then we can decide, or you folks can decide as the university assembly, how to carry this forward. In what way should we have input into this process moving forward? So that's pretty much it.
Thank you for panelists' questions or concerns regarding Resolution 5. I also note that GTSA is going to be in the staff list, not just in the staff for their operations and staffing committee. I've spoken to members of other assemblies to ensure they are aware. That means that there are comments, questions, or concerns for the resolution. Seeing none, I have no speakers list. Are there any motions concerning the resolution on the floor?
Is it a point of order? I think you're going to have a similar thing on this vote. I think the on Resolution 4, the vote was 16-0-1, not 15-0-1. And you're probably going to have 16 people voting again on this resolution. Just
I know we usually don't vote on a resolution the day we introduce it in the UA, but seeing this is the last meeting and we've talked about this for years on years on years, I'm just going to go and ask for us to motion to approve it.
Second.
Second, it also looks actually was introduced in some form in our last meeting.
Mm-hmm. Like an informal.
Our general prohibition on the bill 5. So motion really second. Is there any sense voted on the resolution as before today? Hearing none. All those in favor of the resolution, please raise your hand. I see 16. Thank you, Dale. All those who are opposed? That brings us next to the UA Resolution 6, sponsored by myself. This is actually the one exception to our don't vote resolutions the day they're introduced. This is our annual thank you resolution. I've been on this assembly with a pleasure and honor serving for the past 5 years. It takes a lot for this assembly to go, it really does, from our guests to our committees, the office itself, to our clerks. We really can't do this without them and you as a member. And this resolution goes through and tries to thank everyone who's led the assembly, should run our committees, or should run our capacity, try to catch everyone, generally do. I have to answer any questions on it. It's a ceremonial resolution that's really just saying thank you, because I will say my title personnel, they're grateful to criticize, you don't say thank you quite that. So this is a resolution, I'm happy to answer any questions on it.
Motion to approve.
Second. Wait.
Come on, roll today.
Is this the right way to like spell Pam's name?
Yeah. No.
Hearing no dissent, we'll vote resolution. All who are in favor of resolution 6, please raise your hand or placard. The chair will be affirmative. All who are opposed, all who are thing. I'm very happy to say that I voted. I voted 17-0-0. So it was passed. Thank you very much. This is a discussion on letters in the assembly. Bob, detailing various things concerning sustainability, the requests that we've been working on.
I can go first. Yeah. Just to touch on, if those of you were at the executive session at the meeting 2 weeks ago, we really wanted to make sure that some form of progress was shown by the CJC. We're going to send the entire document that we've been working on with requests from the administration to review it and, where possible, to provide amendments that they would be okay with. So in the fall, the committee can actually begin voting on amendments provided by the university rather than working the other way and never knowing when our amendments are going to be something that the university would be willing to accept, because this entire process this year has led us nowhere. So that'll be happening. The chair of UA and I will be working on that letter, and it'll be reviewed by the committee before being sent to the administration. And of course, all of you included on that email when it's sent, so you'll know what's going on.
Yeah, we just viewed it as a opportunity to work more informally with Day Hall, short of formal resolution. So there are some concrete suggestions, and there are a whole bunch of things to discuss. But at Martha Pollack at the beginning of this academic year said she'd prefer to discuss with us and interact more informally and not just respond to resolutions. So I view this as sort of a proactive way to do that. The memo doesn't purport to represent the UA per se. It purports to represent the people on the CIC.
Any questions? Hearing none, that does exhaust the agenda. The final meeting in September for this term. Are there any final questions, comments, or concerns for the assembly for this term?
I'd like to thank the executive committee and recognize them for all of their work, especially as someone new to shared governance and seeing what happens on the EA and learning what happens on the UA and what the differences are. I learned a lot from everybody this year, and I really appreciate everybody as well as the outgoing members. And Matt, thank you very much. I learned a lot about how to just like motion just from you. So thank you very much.
Those of us on the JA search committee thought that something might be discussed at this meeting, seeing as there's nothing on the agenda. Would there possibly be a necessary additional meeting that's being added that we should be looking out for?
That is incorrect. I received a letter from the president.
Well, I wasn't saying what's right or wrong. I'm just asking if there's going to be an additional meeting that ought to be scheduled. Okay.
I won't be thinking about the assembly on that.
That
being said, any other business? That being said, I
motion to move into executive session.
Motion to move into executive session. Is there a second?
Second.
Great incentive to do it. So, hearing none, the assembly will move into executive session for purposes of future elections and other confidential matters. That being said, we will adjourn to the after. I have the election materials. We'll provide the information to the assembly, the incoming assembly, if we're done. Thank you very much. This session of the University Assembly is hereby adjourned. We have 5 minutes to move into the elections. Members who are voting to be in office, you are free to remain. I would also ask all new members to the assembly to take a seat. We will start about 5 minutes, which we tend to do brief interruptions and move to the left.
Okay.
I'm gonna probably stay till 6.
This happens this semester. Yeah. Do I not have to stay? Okay. Let me just.
I mean, you get to hear like.
I don't want to. Oh, okay. Do I know what to say? Who knows? I never know.
Yeah, all right.
I've supported a few people though, so speaking even when you can't vote.
Yeah.
They were very
it does help.
Hey, Joe. Joe.
I am not funny.
Somebody has. Just like to the executive session, and one of them has to be addressed. And
On the attendance, you know, you probably
just something to think about. Someone, you know, one of you guys run for president and they get elected. Nobody can run for anything. So I think it's good to like discuss amongst you guys if you're planning to do something or which one, you know, anyone wants.
I was planning. So I don't think I've been here long enough that I would want.